Welcome back, everybody, to another episode of Move, Breathe, Live. Today, I have got a great guy called Scott Carney on. He is pretty much he's not the official biographer of Wim Hof. That would be incorrect, but he wrote the first book about Wim Hof. He wrote the first article really about Wim Hof that brought him to the attention of everybody. He's also written an amazing book called The Vortex, which is well worth your read. We discuss it at the beginning. It's just a pretty cool listen all round. He kind of debunks some stuff about Wim Hof, but also praises it an awful lot. And so you can have a listen, see what you think. It's pretty cool. We kind of dive into his idea of what he calls the wedge, which is another book of his as well. So let me know what you think. Hope you're all good and enjoying these episodes. We've got a few more to come next week or in a fortnight. We've got Mike Fitch from Animal Flow. So if you know anything about Animal Flow and you enjoy that, it should be a good episode for you. But in the meantime, enjoy this week's episode with Scott Carney. And yeah, as always, make sure you like, subscribe, comment, rate, review, all of that stuff. And yeah, I'll see you all very soon. Have a great week all. Thanks for coming and joining me. I'm very well. Yeah. Very well.
So your name is Wibbs?
It is, yes. Yeah, it's weirdly short for Alex in a funny story. So
Widley short for Alex. It's all right, what's weirdly the story?
So basically, my full name is Alexander William George Coulson. When I was about 6 months old, my big brother couldn't pronounce my name, and my mother, in all her infinite wisdom, decided she didn't like the name that she'd given me 6 months earlier. Sure. So he used to call me Alexander Wibby George, and then Wibby stuck, and then when I was about eight, it turned to Wibbs, and I've just been Wibbs the rest of my life ever since.
Okay, so your brother named you.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
not traditional, but great. Awesome. Yeah,
it works. Works for me. Yeah.
Let me grab some water. I only have
Go for it.
Let's do this.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Move, Breathe, Live. Today, I am pretty chuffed to welcome a chap called Scott Carney. Hello, Scott.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for having me on.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for joining me. I'm going to pass it over to you and let you perhaps just introduce yourself as to who you are and the books you've written and the journey you've maybe been on, and then we can dive into some bigger questions from there.
Yeah, so I'm my name's Scott Carney. I'm an investigative journalist and anthropologist, and I wrote this book called What Doesn't Kill Us, as well as, you know, five other books. What Doesn't Kill Us was about my journey with Wim Hof, where I started where I started working. I was a reporter doing a story for Playboy magazine, and I had just written this huge feature about how meditation can kill you, like the dark side of meditation, the dark side of yoga, and that all ended up in a book called The Enlightenment Trap. And I was getting very comfortable going out debunking fake gurus, people who are out there to bilk you for money, whose techniques broach insanity. And I'd heard about Wim Hof, who was this sort of naked Dutch dude on an iceberg, saying that he could teach anyone to, hang out in ice water for as long as they wanted and control their immune system with their mind and other things that just seemed impossible. The long story short is that I went out and met Wim Hof. This was in 2011 or maybe 2010. And, you know, Wim Hof was not very well known. This was his very first training course. And I did his method, and it turned out that it worked. So my whole plan for the story failed. And instead, I had to write this article about why you can, you know, resist intense environmental situations with your body, and then how you can actually, to some degree, control your immune system with your mind. So it's been quite a journey for me. And I ended up, again, I do the Wim Hof method every day. I have been sort of a constant practitioner. It's changed. I had this autoimmune illness that has now gone. Mm-hmm. And I ended up climbing up Mount Kilimanjaro with Wim in a very fast period of time, wearing almost no clothing. So yeah, That's like the really short synopsis of my Wim Hof stuff. But, you know, I've also gone beyond that. I've written this sort of book called The Wedge, which is about, you know, after you've been doing the Wim Hof method for a while, what else can you take out of this? What other techniques use the same principles? And so that's a whole nother journey. And I also write about climate change and war and organ trafficking and a bunch of other stuff as well.
I have to say, I definitely want to chat about all of that stuff, obviously, because this is kind of probably where my podcast sits in that kind of the wedge, the what doesn't kill us realm a bit, and even the enlightenment trap. I remember in the book you talk about you know, debunking the crazy yogi people, which is right. Something I definitely want to talk about, but I haven't for some reason I hadn't come across the enlightenment trap book, so I'm gonna get
all right
that one.
Let's do it.
But one I am listening to at the moment is The Vortex, because when we agreed to this, I'd missed it for some reason, and I'm 6.5-7 hours through the audiobook.
Love it.
I cannot stop listening to it. I am absolutely hooked, and I can't believe I knew so little about that whole thing. So I definitely want to broach that subject again, because I think...
And you're listening to the UK edition, right? Because that's the one where I read. Is that right?
Yes, you're reading it. Yes.
Yeah. So we have two editions. One's the American edition, which doesn't have me reading. And there's the UK and rest of the global edition, which has me reading it. So you're the first person I've talked to who's listened to it randomly. So how is it? How does it sound?
It's amazing. It's absolutely at first, because I read the bio. We'll just do The Vortex first. Sorry, while we're here, let's do it. Yeah. I read the bio, and you know, knowing what doesn't kill us and The Wedge and etc. And I was a bit like, oh, I hadn't seen this one. What's this one about? And I was like, oh, it's about Bangladesh. And about like, and I was like, oh, that's interesting. And so I then like listened to it. And then it kind of just started off all about obviously the massive storm where it all kind of kicks off from. And I was a bit like, where's this going? Like I literally had to go back and see if it was actually about like the war and stuff. And then as soon as the first like two chapters were in, it started like laying the thing. And the fact I know your voice through Instagram and through all sorts of, you know, videos and bits and pieces, the fact that you're reading it to me just is
love it.
No, it's better. Yeah, I wish your voice.
I wish it was the global edition, but I got in a fight with my publisher and the details are mundane and, you know, very much inviting.
It just didn't work out.
it just didn't work out. And so they went with a different reader in America, which is too bad, because I feel like this book is in some ways my best book, but I sort of feel like that way about every book that I write.
I'm sure as an author, every time they come out, you feel like this. But I mean, from my perspective, like maybe because it's different from all the work that, you know, the Wim Hof stuff. But for me, because it's such a I'm sure it's not an untold story, but I honestly feel like maybe people have, you know, I'm nearly 40 now, but I kind of feel that it's certainly in England, especially post Second World War, Raj, Indian, you know, when they split it up, what was it called?
Partition,
that's where I had the wrong word. But post that, I kind of feel like we don't get told about any of this. Mm-hmm. And actually I'm up to, I don't know, nearly onto the third verse, whatever you call it, the third
section.
Third section. I'm nearly up to that bit. And it's just, I was listening to it driving home from London yesterday, and it's almost sickening. Do you know what I mean? It's like I feel I had a hole in my stomach of just quite how Nixon and Kissinger and all of that were allowing essentially Yahya to just get away with what he wanted.
Commit genocide. Yeah, straight up commit genocide. So for the listeners who aren't, you know,
we should probably tell them what it's about.
It's about the deadliest storm in human history and how that sparked a series of catastrophic and almost inevitable events that didn't only end with the 500,000 people who died in the storm, but also a genocide in what was then East Pakistan, the liberation of East Pakistan to become the country of Bangladesh. And then, well, I don't want to spoil it for you, Wibbs, but this almost ends in global thermonuclear war. So basically the whole world almost ends because of the events that started with a big hurricane, a big cyclone.
Yes.
And it's
fascinating.
And I lived in India for 6 years. So I, as a, oh, did you, you know, my, as a foreign correspondent, I covered all sorts, mostly international crime out of India, for Wired and Mother Jones and NPR and those people.
Wow.
And it's so strange that I also had never heard about this war. Like, I knew it had existed. I knew that there was a war, but I had no idea what it was about until I ended up on the border between India and Pakistan and saw that that India had built a wall all the way around Pakistan, and that they were doing it because they were afraid of the next big storm might send millions and millions and millions of climate refugees over the border. So they decide to instead just have a preemptive policy to shoot them as they come over. So yeah, the whole situation's bananas. And that's the vortex. And it just came out just a few months ago. So
it's still brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. By the way, when you were in India, and because I spent 6 months traveling through India, I did my yoga training, and then up at the Pakistan Indian border, where they kind of sort of near up near that way, where you can go and like watch the closing of the the border, and that to me was the biggest, for want of a word, better word, joke. Do you know what I mean? It was such a played out, they were both sides doing exactly the same thing, shaking their fists and shouting at each other and then marching back. And they've got bands playing both sides. Mm-hmm. And you kind of think, you guys have managed to somehow make this whole performance, but you hate each other, but you've managed to still put this whole performance together to not make money, I guess, because you don't have to pay to go and do it. But
well, it's better to have a symbolic conflict than an actual conflict.
That's very true.
You know, and if you have to run around like roosters, which is it's the Wagah border. That's the one you're talking
about.
That's
the one. Yeah, yeah.
And if you have to run around like roosters and do a dance for everyone instead of shooting each other, I am all for it. Let's get a big global dance party, all dressed up like chickens, and the world will be a better place. It will.
I remember one of my friends once said, honestly, I think if everyone, I'm not going to say if it was, because obviously, but if everyone just like,
it was Russell Brand.
You took some ecstasy. I don't know Russell Brand. I'd like to say. Yeah, essentially, I'm sure Russell Brand did say, if we all just took some ecstasy and all went and had a big party together, everyone would realize how much they loved each other and there'd be no more fighting.
There's an element of that.
Yeah, exactly. For sure. Well, cool. So if anyone's listening to this, go and buy The Vortex. I've just listened to it, especially as most people who listen to my thing are in the UK. You can hear Scott read it, and it's definitely better with Scott reading. I haven't really listened to the other one, but I'm sure it is better. and it's just fascinating. If you've got any interest in history at all, like this is a history which I kind of feel is missed out and well worth a listen or read. So go and buy that. But anyway, we'll jump back to
the other stuff that I do.
I want to go back to the very beginning and what you just said about how you maybe came across Wim Hof, or how you were set up to maybe become a Chris Wim Hof, with the show it or proving that all these crazy yogi folk were actually just talking a load of old bollocks, for want of a better word.
Yeah, I mean, it's super interesting when you think about the reason I was interested in Wim Hof is because I thought he was fake. Okay, let's just get that right out of the gate. And the reason that I thought he was fake is because Americans and British people and Germans and Europeans in general have been placing a lot of mystical dreams on India since the 1860s. Let's say 1860s, since Madame Blavatsky and the Theosophical Society. And they've been saying, look, there's going to be all these levitating yogis and wisdom masters hanging out in the Himalayas somewhere. And if we can just find them and collect all of their information, we will become Jedis. Essentially, right? And the history of charlatanism is absolutely insane. And it's way more than we can go to in this podcast. But there is a very long occult tradition that blends with also the academic tradition, where we have cast fantasies on mystical India. I mean, hell, even the Nazis did it. The swastika is an Aryan symbol, and Aryans are the white invaders in North India, and we have this fantasy of India being a place of magical thoughts, and we don't look at it in the same way we do at Christianity. In Christianity, you duplicate some fishes, you can walk on some water,
turn some water to wine,
and that's what we do, and then we're Christians, right? And And but we don't look at them as like abnormal. We're like, oh, those are just the stories. But when we see those same types of stories in the yogic traditions, the Indic traditions, we're like, no, those people are magicians.
Real.
And I can learn from them, because in America, and I think to some degree also in England, you have this idea of the Protestant work ethic and the spirit of capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. The idea that if you work hard enough, you can get rich or you can get prosperous. If you think that superpowers are acquirable, it's the same idea. You work hard at yoga, you gain your superpowers. And it just so happens that there are a few Indian texts that promise that, you know, Tibetan and Indian texts that promise that. The Yoga Sutras, which I'm no doubt familiar with. There's a whole book about the Siddhis, which are the miracles, which are the walking through walls, telepathy, levitation, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. All that stuff that you can do if only you meditate hard enough. So together, it's this toxic soup where you get these overblown ideas of what might be possible in by traveling out of your comfort zone. Because you know that in, you know, dusty old England, all you have is Boris Johnson. But over there, they have some levitating yogi people. So let's go over there. Yeah. And then you're thus primed with this knowledge and this sort of like false history. You go to India and then there's people selling that to you. They're like, no, you can levitate. Just join my, you know, pyramid scheme.
Yep.
And, you know, all of that is problematic, because there's actually really good things about the Indian philosophy and Indian religions and yoga. There's health benefits. There's anxiety benefits. There's just sort of like knowing your place in the world benefits that are super, super wonderful. And I love Indian philosophy. But when you take it too far, you end up getting people in trouble, whether it's financial trouble, whether it's health trouble, mental trouble. And so I spent a long time in the Enlightenment drop looking at the dark side of meditation, particularly the mental stuff, particularly the stuff where you start meditating and then time speeds up and it slows down, light quality changes, you see visions, you see like hallucinations. And I know that for Americans, and to some degree, even my first meditations, I'm like, oh my God, I'm special. Yeah. I'm seeing something that no one else has ever seen, like, which is total bullshit. But you get these feelings in you that you're special. And if that mindset continues forward, you literally go insane. That there's when I was writing that book, 100 Westerners every year were ending up in mental asylums in Delhi with so-called India syndrome. And, you know, they're thinking that they were Shiva. They were thinking that they were, you know, these Indic gods or had superpowers. I led a meditation retreat in India where I wasn't the teacher. I was sort of like a program director, so I was an administrator sort of person. Mm-hmm. There was a different teacher teaching it. At the end of the meditation retreat, the best student, the type A, awesome, beautiful, totally together student who'd studied yoga in America, climbed up to the roof of the retreat center and committed suicide by jumping down and banging her head.
I've got experiences of some of my friends, and like even one of my teachers when I was in India, she was, she basically had done, she'd done, you know, she properly was living the life, lived in India, went off traveling, went over to Peru, did like meditations and did shamanistic things with, you know, ayahuasca and all sorts. But she had done numerous vipassanas. And then she was doing the last one she did, she went and did this vipassana. So rather than being like in a room with lots of other people doing it, she kind of just went completely solo and was like in her own space, in her own room, 24 hours a day type thing, food delivered to her, boa. And then she, you know, and I spoke to her just before she went in, completely normal. She comes out and all of a sudden she's posting, you know, the kind of really, I'm going to say real cheesy, kind of enlightened sort of pictures of like the almost like the Tool type, if you know Tool, the band, their kind of album artwork of like exploding consciousness and lots of bright color. Suddenly that's all her Instagram feed was, and she's talking absolute
nonsense.
And then she ends up in a mental home and, you know, mental institution, and I have no idea how, but then she died in the mental institution.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
that's terrible.
Yeah. And then this is what I, in the same way, and this is why I really want to read the Enlightenment Trap now, I think, because, and I've got another friend who's ended up overly meditating, let's say, and ended up in a sort of being sectioned and having all sorts, and still to this day, like, you know, no way has he passed it. Let's put it that way. And I mean, that's the no one seems to get it. It's just we're always told meditation's good.
Mm-hmm. And meditation can be good.
It can be, yeah.
I think the way I think of it is that meditation is not good or bad. Yoga is not good or bad. What they are is powerful. And you can have an experience that is everything holds potential danger, right? Nothing in this world is totally danger free. But people don't take yoga seriously because they think, oh, look, it's, you know, I get to be in a room with hot ladies and we're bending around. That's a good start. Yeah. And then we're going to go and we're going to learn some Indian philosophy and blah, blah. And it sort of like expands into, they never tell you the bad side, right? They never tell you that there's real shit with what they call the dark side of meditation. But if you actually look at the Indic traditions and the Tibetan traditions, there's lots of spiritual sicknesses that are actually documented. There's one called lung, which is, you know, if you were to believe in the energy bodies that are part of those traditions, you know, you have this sort of your physical body and you have this energy body, which is made up of winds, you could call them. Yeah. There's something called lung, which is basically your winds got all out of order. And it's like a cyclone in your body, which makes you insane. And so they have ways to diagnose and think about it in the Indic medical traditions. But it doesn't parallel over into American thought. No. And there's so much money to be made with like flashy yoga poses on top of mountains and like cheesy spiritual memes that we don't take it seriously. And that's a huge problem.
Yes.
And then the gurus get up, they get very big, and then they think that they're enlightened and they tell everyone they're enlightened. And then once you've told you're enlightened, you're fucking insane. Cause that's the definition of insanity is like that you believe that you're talking to God. And then you start, you know, then once you're, and there, you don't have any peers anymore. Once you're enlightened, you don't have peers. You can't look over to the people who used to like, be like, hey, maybe you're going a little too far here. Maybe that's not totally right. You're like, no, I am right. And if you're a man, it's not only I'm right, but my penis is right. Look at my penis. My penis knows what it's going to do. And it's going to fuck all the pretty ladies. Cause that's what penises all do.
Yeah.
And it's like a pattern and we all know it's true. We're like, oh,
I don't get how no one said it. I work for a clothing company called Bamboo Clothing, and I was doing a photo shoot yesterday, and I was telling these girls, there's girls who like do yoga type thing, but they're not big into it. And I was telling them all about like Patabi Joyce and his inappropriate adjustments. And you can look on YouTube and he's literally just humping girls in a yoga studio. Like there's a pose where you lay on your back and you put your knees behind your ears, so your bum's in the sky and your hands behind your back, so you're tied up in this pretzel with your ass in the air. And he was literally just hands on the floor, feet on the floor, and was like pushing them further into the pose with his crotch. And you're and this guy was, he's still to this day, he's seen as like a guru figure, you know. Yeah. At least Bikram has been somewhat, for the most part,
he's fallen, you know, a bit.
He's fallen, and for the most part, people realize that he's a dirty old bastard who's just using, you know, his yogic powers to sleep with you. But people like Patabi Joyce and
happened forever. Like
Iyengar.
It's like if you look at in Bhutan, I don't know if you've been to Bhutan.
I snuck
over the border once.
Did you?
And one of the things about Bhutan, which is supposedly the happiest country in the world, there was this medieval saint named Drukpa Khunle. So this is before any of the stuff that any Americans getting over there, any of that. This is in the Tibetan and Bhutanese tradition. Because this guy named Drukpa Khunle, and if you go to Bhutan today, his symbol is on every wall, like everywhere. And his symbol, and you should Google this, Drukpa Khunle, Kunley, and you can say symbol to see what shows up. And what you will see is an erect cock with hairy balls squirting spooge at the top. And it is on every wall in Bhutan. You're looking it up right now.
I'm going to look it up now.
And what he did, he was like a 13th century dude. And he was like, hey, I'm enlightened. And the way I can get you to enlightenment is by fucking your daughters and all the princesses and the monks. And so he fucked his way through Bhutan, and everyone else was like, well, he's enlightened and I'm not. So guess we're going to him.
There it is. Yeah. I'm guessing that's it. This looks like a book called The Legendary Penis of Drukpa Khunle in Bhutan. And I'm guessing.
Yeah. I mean, there's much better images than that. Okay. Yeah. Just
let's put symbol in.
But like literally like every door and threshold you go through in Bhutan, it's like, yeah, there we go. There we go.
There we go. Look, there classic, classic cock and balls. Even back in the day, you see, it's not just the patriarchy from the last couple of hundred years.
Yeah. And I think that it's like a fundamental problem with power, right? When an absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's exactly. the term, right? And as you get to a point where the power is, I'm getting spiritual insights coming from God, there's literally no one else who can tell you otherwise. And the thing is that that's not how God talks to people. I don't know if you guys have figured this out, but meditation doesn't actually make you special. It just makes you maybe more aware of the present. And there's some cool things to go with that. But yep. once you go over to the point that the things you hear in meditation are actually ultimate reality and real reality, the reality that we all live in is fake reality, the veil of Maya stuff, which you might hear in yoga classes. Yeah, yeah. Once you start going there, it's like no holds barred. Like you can do whatever the fuck you want. And then other people who believe you say, well, they trust your insanity more than their common sense.
Yeah.
And it can get really, really dicey and has gotten dicey over and over again. And we just see this. And it's also the Catholic Church. It's like all over the place.
Yeah.
It's
all right with yoga and with the Indian side. I mean, it's to a certain degree because it's like, it's not religion as such. I mean, I know like Hinduism and like, but you know, you could, there'll be many people who'd say like, oh, yoga's not religious. It's just like spiritual. And so therefore, you know, again, it's kind of given this, certainly this is how it kind of feels with a lot of people I know who they're happier to go with a spiritual thing.
Yeah.
Because there's not God, inverted commas, you know, it's just, it's more about, you know, you are God rather than there being a God. You know, we're all God. We're all the same. We're all things. So therefore it seems more open and more like fluffy than there being like one.
Yeah. And that's only because Westerners don't understand the traditions that this comes from. I mean, it's only Absolutely. The miscommunication between cultures. You know, I love India, but I can talk shit about the religion all day long because there's just so much like actual documented stuff. Like, you know, in the 12 or 1400s, you know, Tibetan monasteries would routinely go and attack and murder every other monk from the rival monasteries, right? They called the Mongols down to kill like the sects that they didn't like. I mean that even your most, you know, sort of iconized, the most iconic sort of peaceful people in the world right now have their shit too. And which is not to denigrate them. It's just to say that everyone is coming from a similar baseline.
But there's also, I mean, there's still monks even to this day who are like, I mean, they still seem like really like aggressive assholes. Do you know what I mean? They're still like going and killing and attacking other people who aren't Buddhists or whatever else in their area. So, you know, they clearly need to do some more meditating. Or left.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of fascist Buddhists right now. One's telling people, you know, vocally talking about having to kill Muslims and the perversion of great religions. But it is a human thing. It's not like necessarily fundamental to any particular religion. No. It has to do with power and political structures. And I think that Westerners who go to these places with these super big ideas are easily sucked into it because they don't have the, you know, in the West, we can be like, well, the Catholic Church has got some shit, right? We all know that the Catholic Church is some shit. And we take that into mind when we, you know, involve ourselves with it, but we don't have that background to look at other cultures. We just say, oh, those cultures are perfect because I haven't learned the culture. Yeah. So it must be perfect, which is why converts to any religion generally are the most adherent. You know, the people who recently convert to Islam are the most Islamic, the recently converted Jews, the most Jewish and all around the world. It's also why the Dalai Lama says that if you're a Westerner, you want to go study Buddhism. Great. But I think you should study your own religion first. Like consider Catholicism instead of Tibetan Buddhism. Like he says that all the time. You're like, okay. You know, he's the DL, he's HHDL, His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Maybe listen to him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I mean, so there you go, guys. Think about it. Don't just go to India. I mean, I definitely have like, there's aspects of, I mean, I went to India, traveled for 6 months and I loved it. And there's, you know, but I've always probably very, I think very much like you, from what I see in this and in on your Instagram and whatever else, is like, I've always got the more skeptical mind of like, science is there. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of like, let's actually just look at things through a slightly more skeptical lens. And, you know, right. There's some amazing stories that you can probably take some lessons from, but let's not actually start extrapolating to, you know, an entire
right. Which is which is why what I did with Wim Hof and the wedge is so interesting, right?
Yes, yeah, exactly.
When I met Wim, I was ready to say that he was just one of these other charlatan gurus, and I've met lots of charlatan gurus. Easy to say. You get off the airplane, and he looks like a homeless dude, right? he's got a big
scraggly
nose
beard.
Yeah, like was an alcoholic for 20 years, at least minimum 20 years of alcoholism, big ruddy nose, smells bad. And I'm like, oh man, this is going to be the easiest debunking I ever did. Right. What's this guy got to show? But you know, we drive out into the mountains of Poland, where he has this very first training session, right? There's only two other people who signed up. It was this Croatian dude and a Latvian dude. And this is his very first one. And I'm present. And you know, the first thing I see when I get out of the van is I go upstairs, I look out the back window into the snowfield. You know, this is January during the winter that stopped the Nazi army, as I like to say. and there's some dude out there in the snow, just throwing snow on himself, and there's steam coming off of his body. And I'm like, what the fuck? And you know, the very, short of it, right? There's a whole book. You should read it. What Doesn't Kill Us? But the short of it is I try his method. It's hyperventilation and then exhaling and hyperventilation and exhaling, holding your breath for a really long period of time and then go hanging out in the snow for a bit. And I'm suddenly able to duplicate pretty much all the things that Wim is able to do very, very quickly. And mm-hmm. I think that's one of the awesome things about the Wim Hof method is it doesn't, they don't have to, Wim doesn't have to say, look, sit here and study me for 10 years. And at 10 years, you're going to get these superpowers. It's more like you're going to get this tomorrow and you're not going to be really, we're going to be able, Wim and you are going to be able to do the same thing because these powers are not like prana from heaven. It's just evolutionary things that we all have programmed into
physiology.
And we are weak because we are comfortable all the time and we're not in natural environments. And so what, you know, even calling it the Wim Hof method is a little silly. It's more like, maybe Wim Hof has some principles. Yeah. And the reality is it's just evolution. He didn't invent breathing. He did not invent cold baths. He just has a really cool marketing package, which, you know, which is great for him. And you find that, you know, I ended up climbing up Kili with him and I was, you know, basically naked. It was negative 30 degrees outside. That's actually the same in Fahrenheit and Celsius. So no need to convert that to me. Look, there's a selfie that went around the world and you know, it didn't feel great. Yeah, look at me. And women as little bird shorts.
So when you went and hiked that, or let's go back to your first day in the snow, because I know I've kind of read it in the book, but like, mm-hmm. obviously you said it was fucking horrible that first day you went outside and it hurt.
Right. Yeah.
Now, as you basically, so one of the things, you know, because I'll be honest, I haven't practiced Wim Hof huge amounts. My practice of breathing is kind of the opposite end of the scale. So I kind of like, I'm into free diving. And I'm also into kind of the free diving side. So I kind of much more hold my breath for 5 minutes, but like without the hyperventilation side of things.
And you should never mix the two. No one should ever mix the two. Yeah.
And I kind of, you know, I kind of want to try, you know, in my head, like I've got a friend who's a Wim Hof instructor just around the corner from me, and mm-hmm. like he puts on days, and I kind of feel like I want to go and try it for you know see what it's all about, because in my head, like when, like I guess because we're in Suffolk and in England and it's not that cold, even when it's gray and wet, but we don't get cold, that, you know, it's -5 at most type thing, but damp,
right?
But like the warmth, how, like for me, it's I guess that there's the brown fat thing. So let's just go over that, I guess. So you're outside, it's fucking freezing. And yet you, within a few days of being in Poland, you're able to start to have no real worries being outside in the cold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you're also being able to melt the snow. Is that, were you finding that?
The snow melts around me, right? As hot thing would melt things around me. It wasn't like, you know, I was a superhero and like 40 feet of snow all melted. And but it was like, but you know, it was, I was warm. And the thing is that you can control your response to the cold. And it, this mm-hmm. is the technique that I call the wedge, where you just place your intentions between you and your bodily response, right? Your bodily response in the cold is to shiver and tighten up. And what you do is you say, I will relax. I will relax in this environment because it's not going to kill me. And by doing that, by some voodoo in your body, your body finds a different way to heat itself other than shivering, which is an effective way to heat yourself up. But it finds a different way to do it. And you heat yourself up with most likely, and I think there's actually some scientific debate on this, a tissue in your body called brown adipose tissue, which you have about a teaspoon of between your two shoulder blades. That's where it sort of hangs out, which is also why when you tense up, that is the achy area. That's the brown fat. And what that does is it sucks white fat from your body and, like a stove, burns it for heat energy. And this is, it's, you know, it's a well enough understood mechanism that you're able to activate this. But if you don't ever try, it'll never do its job. And you know, the pain that I felt initially was really because my body had just never touched the snow before. It's designed to touch the snow. It just never had done it because I lived in LA at the time. And before that, I lived in India. And I was like, why would anyone go outside in bare feet in the snow? It doesn't make any sense. But we evolved, right? We didn't evolve with shoes. We evolved with our tender little feet. And it's something that we're absolutely able to do. So the first experience of pain is something called vasoconstriction, which means your arteries have muscles in them, and their job is to shunt blood to the core in order to keep your main body warm, sacrificing the extremities. And if you've never touched the cold, you can't activate that system, and the inactive system is painful when it starts up. You know, one of the takeaways in the book is that, you know, it's, you know, we like to think about human health as either like diet, you know, the stuff you put in your body, and exercise. Like that's like some combination of those two things are going to keep you healthy. But the important takeaway is that there's actually a third pillar, which is the environment that you inhabit, because the environment is always sending signals to your nervous system to do different things. And if you're not giving it the stimulus it needs, you can't just think your way into vasoconstriction. And I've asked Wim this a lot. He's like, can you just look at your hand and make it warm up or cool down? And sometimes he says he can do it, but he can't do it. I've never seen him do it. He's,
I can when no one's looking.
Exactly. Exactly. And I like calling Wim out on his bullshit. but he, you know, it's only something that's when you're in the environment, you can activate it. But when you're in the environment, you can sort of choose how it activates. That actually is true, because you can decide what sensations you want to feel and what those sensations mean to you. And that's where the wedge gets really interesting, is that, you know, in general, you have these two nervous systems, right? Parasympathetic and sympathetic. That's sympathetic is fight or flight. Parasympathetic is rest and digest. And when you, And everything you do has to be in one of those two tones in your body. Like you either have to be in rest and digest or fight or flight. There's no like ennui and doing taxes side of your nervous system. You're always one of those two things. And anytime you have a sensation, it's essentially a choice for how you want to respond, right? Mm-hmm. And it's usually automatic. Like pain, you want to go into fight or flight. Because pain, there's something bad there that's attacking me, and I'm going to go into fight or flight. But you don't have to. You know, someone could punch you. This is not really a practice that I'm going to recommend, but someone could punch you and you could get really pissed, right? Or you could be like, turn the other cheek and just relax into that. Now, whether you want to or not, that's irrelevant to this. It's the fact that you can choose, which is so important. And you can choose in the cold to relax. You can choose to get more worked up. And that power to express that in that environment really generalizes to absolutely everything you feel in the world. Anytime you see the word feel come up in English, whether it's an emotion, I feel like I love you, or I feel like I hate you, or I feel ennui, or I do not like Boris Johnson because he makes me feel bad. You know, any of those things, those are feelings. And then you have a choice with those. And you can say, you can change your feelings. And that's a really sort of interesting thing when you realize that sensation is emotion and sensation always offers a choice.
And that's where I guess the daily practice of doing this, so of especially the cold side, again, I'm assuming also the hyperventilation side and the breath holds, because again, I've not done huge amounts of breath holds post hyperventilation, so I'm probably not, you know, that au fait on kind of quite how you feel with it. But certainly from my side of view of breath holds, of doing kind of, my record is about 5 minutes 15, that's fucking uncomfortable. By the time you get to that point, your body is like essentially screaming, fighting you, and you know, you've got bodily contractions going on, and yet my choice in that moment is to stay calm and to sit with it, and that plays out into life.
So, and actually, it weirdly enough, it saved my life a week ago. A week ago, I was on a rafting trip in Idaho, and I got kicked off my boat and dropped into a hole behind a rock. So when you think about how a river goes, you've got millions and millions of tons of water flowing over, and there's a smooth rock, and behind the rock, there's a whirlpool where the eddies sort of flow backwards. I got knocked off into that eddy about a week ago today, and I was dunked in, and you know, usually you get kicked out the other side, like when you expect to go to rapid, you expect to go down river. But this, I was caught, and I was caught underwater for about a minute. And I think one of the reasons I survived is because I relaxed. I was like, look, nature has me at the moment. It's running me around its washing machine, and I can, it picks me up just for like a breath, just like a second of a breath. And I take a little breath and right back under. And I had this moment where I was like, look, this is not going to be the end of my story. I'm going to be able to get on. I'm going to relax. I'm not going to panic at all. And I'm going to wait for my opportunity. And my opportunity showed up when this rock, when I felt the rock with my hand, this totally smooth, and I couldn't see it, but I know it was green with black flecks. I don't know why I know this, but I know it in my soul. And I put my hands on it and I pushed against it. And like, that was my opportunity. And just that mere fact of pushing against it, enough water built up between me and the rock that I got kicked out the other side. And it is that ability to, in that stressful, honestly deadly situation, because everyone who was watching me on the outside thought I was dead. Like there was a whole crew of like 12 or 20 people who were there. It was like, oh my God, Scott just died in front of us. And, but by being able to, you know, wait for the opportunity, not freak out, not panic and suck in water was pretty important at that moment. And I think it comes from all this training that I've done, and it's not just Wim Hof method. Honestly, the wedge, this idea of being calm and stress, can be learned in 100,000 techniques. Like doing stuff lets you do more stuff. And anything that's hard, you know, you can learn this on your bicycle. You can learn this in your MMA fighting. You can learn this in your yoga. You can learn this in your Ashtanga. You can learn this in your meditation. You can learn this in the sauna. You can learn this at the fucking DMV, you don't, I don't know if you have that.
We've got DMV. What's DMV?
The Department of Motor Vehicles. It's like, it's the registration of your car where there's always a really long
DVLA over here. DVLA.
Sure.
I mean, you know, and you talk in the book about, like, I guess another way of, like, you know, well, kind of, I think in the book he was kind of doing it, but a guy I've had on the podcast called Brian McKenzie.
Oh yeah. Brian's great.
Cool. So, and he, you know, like he's, in, well, you know, trained all sorts of people, but like, you know, again, his and shifts thing at the moment is very much, you know, it's like that kind of high intensity, you know, smash it, nearly die, like chill the fuck out, you know. And again, it's not Wim Hof, it's not whatever, but it's another way that you push your body and you kind of remain calm, and you find that way to kind of go, I'm fine, all I've got to do is just breathe and then relax, and I'm there, and then I can go again. And it's kind of always, it's just that mental side, which is, for me, is really the whole purpose of any of this. It's, to me, like the whole purpose of the yoga, of whatever, is really just how can I be better at handling life. And really, I think that's, to me, what, again, I do the ice baths, but I don't obviously the hyperventilation, but that's really what Wim Hof is kind of getting at.
Yeah, absolutely. Wim Hof and everyone, like, no, none of us created these ideas, right? Like these ideas at least go back to to the ancient Greeks and the ancient yogis and the ancient Chinese. Like the idea of putting yourself in a hard place and then pushing through it, or using the environment to gain resilience, grit or flow, as I like to think of it. It probably goes back Stoics before humans. It probably goes back to like before Homo erectus. It probably goes back to before bonobos. It might go all the way back to when we were single cell creatures resisting the environment as amoebas. I mean, it's old teaching.
That's so true. Yeah. And it's really, I mean, that is evolution in so many ways, isn't it? It's like resist something to get stronger at it, and then you'll reproduce. And it probably is back to amoebas.
I think about this all the time, is like, why are we conscious? Like, why did consciousness show up? And I think it's because consciousness allows, you know, you can have automatic stimulus. There are things where the creature, whatever it is, responds directly and there's no intervention. But sometimes you need to make a choice in the environment, right? Sometimes the environment gives you two options, and an automatic response is mechanical, it's chemical. And that is not always useful for evolution. And so consciousness, I think, goes at least back to amoebas. Because if you look at an amoeba under a microscope, you're like, it sort of hunts other things. It does things. It's like, I will eat this, but I won't eat that. Like, it's probably not thinking big thoughts. Like, you're not going to read it Chaucer. You're not going to have it vote. It probably would vote for Boris Johnson. I don't know. But
judging by how some of the people are voting over here, it's almost certainly going to.
Right. So good thing the amoebas are not given the right to vote, but whatever amoeba thought that it has, it is reacting. And that reaction is based on some sort of choice. It's not a choice that you and I can probably conceive of with our brains, because our brains just operate on different ways levels, and different environments. But anytime there's a choice, it's conscious. And anytime you are trying to decide what to do in an environment, that is changing your future, changing how you react to the world at large. And so it's a very, very deep, very, very biological and consciousness process.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Cool. So if someone, like, bearing in mind, like, where you are, where we are, like, there ain't much snow around us. if someone perhaps listens to this and they kind of go, oh, I really want to, like, maybe start exploring the cold. What's like, from, you know, what would you suggest as ways that they can maybe start leaning into different ways they can explore these things?
Anytime you find a place that makes you uncomfortable, you realize you're in a place where you can practice these techniques. And the easiest, the one that pretty much everyone recommends, is cold showers, right? Because a cold shower, you've already thought of it as like this warm, comfortable space. You clean yourself there. It has all these associations with it. You know that if you turn that knob the other way and sit in that cold, well, you don't want to do it. Nobody wants to do that, because everyone wants comfort. And so there's actually a very, very deep physical and mental practice by turning that knob and then suddenly getting showered with something cold and then telling yourself, and this is really, really important, that it's not so bad. That's actually the practice. It's not just the turning the knob. It's like sitting there. And after you have that feeling, then you have to say, I relaxed into it. Because if you take the cold shower and you say, I just grit my way through it the whole time and it was horrible, and but I did it because it's good for me, because it's fucking horrible, you didn't do the practice. The practice is sitting there and saying it's okay.
So on a physiological level though, if you were doing that and you were just gritting and bearing and like every day, I fucking hate it, would there still be a brown fat conversion element to it?
Possibly. I don't care about brown fat. You know, if you want to talk about brown fat, Andrew Huberman has a spiel on it. But personally,
for me, I'm the same. I'm very much like, psychologically is the most important thing.
Right.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you know, I was just thinking that, you know, what the way you said it, I was wondering, like, if you did just do that, I'm sure there would still be a physiological change. But really, again, the whole point is we want to use, as you call it, the wedge. We want to use our wedge to actually benefit our life, not just grin and bear through shit and just, you know, get a bit of brown fat on our back.
I don't care that we're human machines. Like, there's physical things that we can do to our body, put stimulus there where there's no consciousness involved and you get outputs. We know that's possible, but I think that philosophy is very well documented. in other parts of the world. What is interesting to me is how everything is a meditation that you do. There's physical and it's not all parasympathetic. It's not all calming down. It's also ramping up. Yeah. And I also think the science around brown fat, there, it's clear what brown fat can do, but it's not clear that it's the only thing that does it. It could also be that that the heating component with the Wim Hof method has nothing to do with brown fat, but it actually has to do with mitochondrial activation, absent brown fat entirely. So it's, or another process. And for me, I can talk physical explanations because I've read a lot of physical, I'm comfortable in that world, but I think it's more important to think of what is actually happening and allow mystery and sensation to guide it. As long as you're not hurting yourself, and sensation is actually a better guide to what's actually hurting you and damaging you than, say, Andrew Huberman.
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And again, going into the book and the keeping warm and whatever else, and the way Wim talks about doing it, and he's there, and like, because I've never really explained, like, explored it until the book, but he talks about like the muscle squeeze, for want of it, and almost trying to pinch up towards like your pineal type spot.
Yeah. Wait, what book did he mention that in? Does he mention that in?
No, I think you were just talking about it in.
Oh, okay. Right. In the wedge. I write about it. Yeah.
Well, I think you talk about it in this one
there
too.
Yeah. Okay.
You just talked about it in like one of the early chapters, because he was in the, you all go and jump in the, you're outside, then you go and get into the hot tub or into the sauna. And then basically.
I remember my book now.
It was a while back. What was it? 2016 or something.
I wrote it in 2015. I mean, well, there you go. 7 years ago.
7 years ago. I'm going to try and see if I can feel it. But when you do that, like, do you feel like a rush of heat almost from the feet up, or is there a warming effect when you do that?
It starts in the back of the head and spreads through the shoulders and then into the body when it works. And honestly, it only works some of the time for me. And it's a variation of his also DMT breathing. There's another type of breathing that he does.
Okay.
That will give you sort of a psychedelic trip. And it's very, very related to that technique. I write about it in the wedge. So I sort of document it in the back. And it works. And it sort of is voodoo and like, wow, what's going on? There's no scientific studies on it that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
And I'm not even sure how much is psychosomatic, or if psychosomatic matters, if it still heats you up. Like, I don't totally know what's going on there, but I do know that it looks like he's activating the areas that are connected to, like, through the nerves to brown fat.
Right.
You know when you're really cold, cold, sometimes you like clench your jaw.
Yeah.
Right. Just naturally, you clench your jaw. That's a sort of a physical thing you do. I think that's actually related to this technique. I think it's that sort of tensing. And I think that's like squeezing brown fat deposits in some way that's triggering that. And so what Wim is doing is just sort of like doing it's, that consciously first.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Matt, it's amazing. Like, you've got to give it to the guy. Like, I mean, maybe if you spend that much time in cold water and in ice baths, you're going to figure shit out. But like, how he explored some of this and like found some of this out is kind of unreal, really, isn't it? You've got to give it to the guy.
Yeah. Wim is amazing. I love Wim. I mean, you know, we talk on WhatsApp fairly regularly. And he's like, he really opened the door for millions and millions of people, and he changed my life completely. Like, he went from being like this smelly homeless guy to being like, wow, you have real wisdom here, and I love it.
Yeah.
It's funny though, when I talk publicly about him, I feel like I have to be very clear that we should not put him on a pedestal, because a lot of people, you know, we had this whole discussion about enlightened gurus. I wrote that article and it really gave him a boost in credibility in the world, right? It was like, Wim is
legit.
He's got something. He's legit. And what has happened in the 10 years since then, 12 years since then, is that he's sort of become a celebrity in and of himself. And he talks a lot of madness, like a lot of crazy shit comes out of his mouth, which is not tied to science, which is, you know, it's just tied to his own ego and his own sort of like, wherever his brain is going. And I believe that he is being trapped by the cult of fame that is around him. And I think people forget that Wim is not only, you know, I call him a prophet and a madman. Like, he's not only a guy who's a prophet in the sense that he's shown us something that has really given a huge benefit to the world, but he is also a madman. And do not fucking forget that he is a madman too. And do not follow him up every mountain, because he will get you killed. Yeah. And I think that's still there. And I think that if I'd written What Doesn't Kill Us again today, I would have been much harder on that lesson. And yeah, I would have talked about some of the badness. And if anyone's really curious, I have this YouTube channel. It's like Scott Carney or something like that. I don't know. You can find it. And I have a description. I have a description of how Wim almost destroyed his entire, all of his intestines by giving himself an almost fatal enema. Because he was insane. And I want you to think about the time where he swam into the middle of a fountain and put his asshole right on a fountain in Holland. It shot through all of his intestines like a water knife and almost killed him. And I think I want you to think about that anytime you take any of his advice.
So was that before or after he took you up a mountain?
It was way before. I knew the story. Funnily, my editor told me not to put the story in What Doesn't Kill Us. We had a conversation about it. I was like, it sort of undermines its credibility, blah, blah,
yeah,
blah.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and there was this big discussion about like why we shouldn't have that in the book. And now I'm kicking myself for not having that in the book. The video is called something like, well, how did Wim Hof get this scar? And you should watch this video to know what's up with Wim Hof's scar, because it's a banana story. And it's more importantly, it's a cautionary tale for, you know, thoughtlessly following a guru, because what the Wim Hof method was when I started, it was very small. And now it's millions of people. And a lot of those people call Wim a god and infallible, and that's fucked up.
I mean, like over in the UK, he's on BBC One now, like, which I think you know, you posted on Instagram a while back saying why is my book at like back in the charts, and I don't know if it is or not, but certainly until he wrote his book just recently, yours was like the main kind of Wim Hof book, really, wasn't it? I mean, now he's on there, and you know, Russell Brand's kind of tagged me every couple of weeks and all sorts.
He's gotten a boost from all the celebrities. And funny, the book that he wrote was actually not, I mean, Wim didn't write the book, because Wim can't write a book. It was written by the, editor of What Doesn't Kill Us, Mark Weinstein, who actually ghost wrote the book. But yeah, it's,
there you go. That's that.
There you go.
That's that. And just briefly, cause I thought it was super cool. And this is where I kind of, wanted to get in touch with you, I guess, was, you posted something recently about Wim Hof and tinnitus, because this was always something which I found interesting, because I had a client come to see me who had, she had been doing Wim Hof for a little while, but then she went and did, I've forgotten the woman's name. There's a woman in LA who's got a big breathing practice type thing, and I've forgotten what her name is. And apparently her words were, this is the woman who came to me, her words were, it's like Wim Hof, but like on steroids, essentially. Okay. So, you know, essentially, rather than just like a half an hour, you do like 3 hours of like, and it's not just holotropic, but anyway. So
it's something that shows up in LA. I get it.
Yeah. She basically like just essentially blew her ears out and ended up with like horrendous tinnitus.
Yeah.
And then you obviously posted something just recently about, and then you kind of spoke to Brian, you spoke to Wim as well. And I thought, and then I obviously spoke to Robert Fortune, who's like from HHFP, and was like, oh, you should definitely chat to Scott. And I thought that was really interesting, because again, this kind of, and again, this isn't Wim Hof. This is just breathing practices and taking like word as writ, like type thing. And there's always risks up and down, whether you want to go sympathetic or parasympathetic, there's risks that you can imbibe to either one. But the tinnitus was something I felt was quite interesting. And I like the fact that you kind of came back around to it and like was really highlighting it to him and to the world.
Yeah. I mean, I'd been hearing about tinnitus for, I can't pronounce it. I don't know. I've been hearing about tinnitus and, and Wim Hof method for a long time. A lot of people have been writing to me about it, and I sort of like discounted it because I didn't think it was real. But I probably got personally 15 emails from people like, now I have tinnitus. And so I looked into it. I said, yeah, sure, I'll look into it. And the output of this video is that, yes, the Wim Hof method can make tinnitus worse. Mm-hmm. Because what tinnitus is like sort of like overactive sympathetic nervous system. It sort of corresponds to anxiety. And with the Wim Hof method, what the upregulation with the hyperventilation is, it triggers all the sympathetic nerves that are part of anxiety. And if you don't rebalance it with a proper down hold, which is the exhale breath hold, you can get out of whack. And I think a lot of people are hard charging who get into the Wim Hof method. Definitely. And they're sort of prone towards sympathetic stuff anyway. And so it's a big issue. But it's not that the really cool finding was not that Wim Hof method causes tinnitus, because tinnitus doesn't actually happen in the ear. It happens in the brain, because all consciousness basically happens in the brain. And what happens is, as we get older, depending on how many rock concerts we've gone to, you lose hearing in certain bands of the audio spectrum. And the brain, being not a bro, is like, well, look, I'm hearing the world, but this band is deaf and it can't hear anything. So I'm going to put my own soundtrack in there, like a shitty DJ. And it's and the shitty DJ is just that ringing or whooshing or whatever, however your tinnitus presents itself. And it's only happening in your brain, and it's broadcasting it into your audio centers. So there's a feedback loop is, as that whooshing happens and as you become more aware of it, the brain's like, dude, you're listening to my rad tracks, and it just keeps on putting more of that music into your ear until it drives you crazy, and it can be really bad. Some people go suicidal from this. And so the way to fix it is down regulation. It will not stop the hearing loss. That was damaged just by aging. You're gonna get tinnitus anyway as you get older, but you can change how you react to it, and then it sort of goes away because that feedback loop gets disrupted, and then it sort of diminishes. So if you have it from the Wim Hof method, first stop doing the Wim Hof method for a little bit. It's not helping you, especially the breath work. The cold is still probably fine. Don't do the breath work for a little bit, and then focus instead on something like box breathing, which is very simple. Slow inhales, hold at the top, slow exhale, hold at the bottom, and then repeat over and over again. And that sort of breath work is called down-regulating breath work, and will, anything that helps for anxiety should help for tinnitus.
Cool. Yeah, I think that's super, super cool and interesting. And again, it comes back to what we've kind of already said about your wedge. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of choosing to, like, essentially disrupt that signal, downshift and focus on something else, and use a slightly different wedge to kind of to find that space. So, well, thank you very much. I mean, we've basically waffled on for an hour, and I reckon I could probably keep going, because I didn't touch on any of your anthropology side of things. And I find anthropology is like, I mean, I think if I could go back in time and I could go and restudy, I'd probably want to study some kind of anthropology, because I think it's fucking fascinating.
Well, luckily, it's a very highly paying career.
Yeah.
All anthropologists are very wealthy.
One of the women I had on a while back, she wrote a book called Jaws, Sandra Khan. It was like about a hidden epidemic of like mouth breathing, essentially, and snoring and sleep apnea. But she had been an anthropologist, and then weirdly she gave that up to go and become an orthodontist and kind of study that side of things instead. So, I don't know which one had the more money, but I'm guessing it probably might not have been the anthropology.
Yeah, no one's hiring anthropologists for their anthropology right now. I'll tell you what.
Well, before we do finish though, have you got any little tips? If you were to say, if someone was to come and hang out with you for a little while, and you would go, look, why don't you try this for a couple of minutes a day, and whether to move, breathe, or just generally live?
The easiest we've already sort of gone over, like take a cold shower, like straight up try doing the thing which is you know, the cold shower is essentially death, touching your nervous system, and be courageous and relaxed in the face of death, and turn that shower to cold. Just do it for a minute and try to get to the point where you are, you realize it's just sensation on your skin. And yeah, that is actually a very, very deep practice. And it's super easy to do because you have cold water, and it doesn't really matter. This is really interesting. It doesn't really matter the absolute temperature of the water. What matters is the differential between the heat and the cold, because that's how you sense. You don't have a thermometer in your body. You have I am right now at this temperature, and then I've changed to this other temperature, which is why I love doing ice baths in the winter, because it's already cold out, and it doesn't actually feel as cold to get into the cold water in the winter. And that doesn't seem intuitive to most people. They're like, cold out and I'm going to get colder. That seems terrible. No, way harder in the summer. And I would say, like, anytime you can, you know, have the opportunity, I know cold bathing is big in the UK, regardless of the Wim Hof stuff. You know, try doing that stuff. When you do a polar plunge, right? When you have, you know, that's a big thing. Jump in, but don't immediately jump out. What people do in the polar plunge, they jump in, they're like, and they're still in that high excited point when they run out. Wrong. What happens when you do that is you lock in the anxiety of that moment and that heightened state. What the actual deep practice is to get in, relax, and swim around a little bit and be like, this is fine. And then you change your entire physiology and your entire mental relationship to the external world.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for giving me your time today. And like I say, I'm definitely going to pick up the Enlightenment Trap next, because that's the next one I want to read. But if you guys want to read Scott's New York Times bestseller, there it is. Look, New York Times bestseller.
I know, I got the sticker.
Exactly. That's proper on there too. What Doesn't Kill Us? That's worth a read. Although, as he says, he'd probably rewrite it slightly differently now. And I can definitely highly recommend The Vortex. Can't wait to finish it, because that's amazing. And slightly different subjects, but it's super well written and fascinating. So where can people find you, Scott, if people do want to come? I know you don't know what your YouTube is, so it's probably pointless saying, but I'll put
it
in the
probably notes. Like SG Carney, or because basically like all Instagram the socials stuff. SG Carney is basically where I'm, but it might be Scott Carney author. I don't know, just find out. There's a thing called Google. It's great.
I'll find it and I'll stick it in the notes so that all the lazy people can still find it.
And YouTube is really where I'm putting in most of my social media efforts. Cool. Now I've decided that A, I hate social media, and B, if I do want to be on it, I want to be able to talk longer, and YouTube's the only place I can do that. So that's where I am lately.
Very true. Very true. Well, thank you so much for giving me your time and chatting to me, and it's been an absolute pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks, Wibbs.
No worries.